only on the.
Were there any questions last time? Any questions last time?
All right, so I'm kind of dragging, you know, we're wading through this structure formation, evidence for dark matter thing, which I'm gonna kill off fairly soon here. Where I'm heading, you remember, is we want an observable which sees how density fluctuations are growing. And the story was that when we plot log rho against log A, matter is dominating radiation at late times, but this time of equality is a key scale whose value is telling you something about how much non-relativistic matter you had, and it was more than the baryons if we believe the fits that you get to cosmology. So this would be the baryons. And whether or not this happens here or here is an observable thing, is where we're heading towards. So the upshot of last class was, you know, once, so non-relativistic matter can grow will grow proportional to A of T. So let's say delta proportional to A of T. Once the mode delta K satisfies K over A is less than H, and rho matter is bigger than rho radiation. So we have to be matter dominated, and we have to be inside the Hubble scale. And so how do you measure this? So the important thing will be, important observation is this, that if you consider a mode, so this is a time-dependent criterion, right? If you imagine plotting A times H against time, which you could think of time as being A, if you like, and we can do, probably we'll want to do a log plot again so that things are straight lines. This would be log time. Then what's AH doing? So I'm just multiplying through here by A. So remember that in radiation domination, A was proportional to T to the 1/2. So H, which was A dot over A, is 1 over 2T. Whereas, if I think of A going like 1 over T to the 1/2, that means that this is proportional to 1 over A squared. And so this together says that AH is proportional to 1 over A during radiation domination. So as A gets larger, AH is getting smaller. So there's some sort of a thing like that. If we had done the same thing during matter domination, A would have gone like T to the 2/3. So H would be 2 over 3T. Again, it's going like T, so that's like A to the 3/2. So that's proportional to 1 over A to the 3/2. And so that means that AH will be proportional to 1 over root A. So it's falling in both cases, but falling faster during radiation domination. So now if I take two different momenta, K1 and K2, let's say K1 is smaller than K2. Here's K1, here's K2. You see what happens is that the larger K satisfies this criterion first as time goes to the right, and then the smaller K then satisfies it later. And so you can imagine that there'll be some time, which will be the time of radiation matter equality. And so there'll be a magic K that satisfies this criterion right at this instant of radiation matter equality. So let's say that K equality is equal to AH at radiation matter equality. So it's equal to AH at T equality, if you like. So the Ks that are bigger than that will have come inside the Hubble scale before radiation matter equality. So they'll have done that when things were radiation dominated. And the ones that are smaller than that will be the ones which will reenter during matter domination, which is kind of to the right of that line. So if K is bigger than K equality, then you satisfy K equals AH during radiation domination. And if K is less than K equality, then this is true during matter domination. So why do you care? You care because of this criterion here, that all the ones to the right that cross the horizon during matter domination can immediately start to grow because they satisfy this one already. But all the ones to the left that cross the Hubble scale during radiation domination can't start to grow because they haven't satisfied point two yet. So they have to wait for radiation matter domination and then they can start to grow. So what we should expect to be happening is that all the ones here should be stunted compared to the ones here because they had to wait before they could grow. Did I get that right? Yes. So what we expect is fluctuations with k bigger than k equality are stunted relative to those with k less than k equality because they had to wait for radiation matter domination to start. Before growing. So if we think of what the amplitude of these fluctuations were at some earlier time, which we might want to predict later, then what we should expect to happen is that as the universe evolves through this period of radiation matter domination, what will happen is that the modes with small k are going to get stunted compared to the modes with well, the ones with large k are going to get stunted compared to the modes with small k. And that should be observable if we could measure some, if we have some way of measuring what these deltas are. So how would you measure what the deltas are? Let's do this on another board. So how do we measure delta? Well, so in cosmology, you know, the one of the main things that they do is it's kind of a mug's game to predict the universe in detail because a lot of cosmology is contingency. It's like the solar system. And why do we have rocks here, here, and here? Part of it will depend on how we started the universe off. So what in trying to make robust predictions, what they often do is they make statistical statements about the distribution of matter in the sky. So what, rather than talking about a particular kind of the density here or density there, what they talk instead of is about the power spectrum for density correlations in the sky. So to do that, what you might do is look at the density-density correlation function. So rather than follow rho of x, which is what delta, remember delta was delta rho over rho. It is less contingent to measure the correlation, the density-density correlation. So what that would be is take the say delta of x and delta of x, so x plus x prime, say x prime and x plus x prime. And then do an average over this, where we the average is over x prime. So take a, you know, you see something there, a galaxy there, you ask, what's the likelihood of seeing a galaxy there? And then you don't just do, at some distance x away, and in principle, we're going to be interested in some fixed distance, and we won't worry about the directions. But you don't really care if it's in that direction or that direction. What you really want to know is, if I take a random galaxy in the sky in any direction, what's the likelihood of finding another one nearby? And so the purpose of averaging over x prime is that you're not, it might be that there's a big thing over in the sky over there that makes that direction a special direction. So what you do is you average over all possible directions, but you want to know what's the likelihood of, given there being a galaxy here, of there being another one at a certain distance away. So that's something which you can calculate given this. So remember that delta of x in position space, x and t, was the integral d3k 2 pi cubed of delta k of t evi k dot x. So what you can do is you can plug that into this, and this will be, you know, you're going to get two integrals over momenta. You're going to do one integral over x prime. That'll give you a delta function for momentum, which will do one of the momentum integrals, and you'll be left with a momentum integral here, d3k, of what you would call the power spectrum, p of k. And I'll put a delta here just to remind you that we're looking at the correlations of, let's say, a rho, rather than, because you could imagine doing this for various variables besides the density, e to the I, k dot x. So this is the thing that you can get a handle on observationally by measuring the correlations of where density is in the sky.
Question.
Yeah.
So when do you actually do the average over x prime? Is it a direction or is it?
It's a direction, yeah. So this you know, you take some specific direction and you say, what's the likelihood of finding a galaxy here?
X prime is actually it's a unit vector. Right?
No, x prime is just some, it's like a, you know, that way. Oh, you're saying direction versus distance.
Yeah.
So this is actually in three dimensions to start off with. But when you actually talk about the CMB or something, what you're going to really want to do, so there's two things. If the galaxy distribution, in principle, you want it in three dimensions. But when you look at the CMB, then you're just looking at directions, and so then you'll have to project onto the sky, and you'll integrate over the radial direction.
So I'm just worried about the exact definition of the average.
So this is really three-dimensional integrals, and these are all positions, including distance. But it is true that there later on, when you talk about CMB, there will be a different thing, which will just be a direction-dependent thing. But this is not that. This is really, in principle, physically you care if they're how far, you know, physically how far away they are, because that's what the you know, physics will care about distances. Right. So if I kind of use this in here, then what's happening is that p rho of k is basically, you know, delta k squared. So if you know how delta is behaving in time, you also know what p is doing in time. So they're related to each other, but this is the thing that you can see. And the point of, and typically it's also going to be true that a special role is played by power laws in cosmology, and so. In particular, it's often it's going to turn out that it's for parts of momentum space, p turns out to be given by power law. So and that power is often called. So you could have some amplitude, but then k to the n, and this n or ns, if you like, is what you call the
spectral
index. Thank you. And in particular, ns equals 1 is special because that's scale invariant, and it doesn't look scale invariant the way I'm writing it. And it's called, that's called the Harrison-Zeldovich So that's a scale invariant. Spectrum. And it turns out that for small k, this is what this with n very close to 1, but not exactly equal to 1, is what's seen. And that'll be one of the things that we're going to want to explain in the primordial fluctuations part of the story. So, but before we get there, you know, I want to. How does this story play in?
Is it obvious why K should, P should be a power law?
No. But if it was scale invariant, it would be plausible. So let me kind of maybe do that first. Why is n equals 1 scale invariant? Why is that what's special about that? It doesn't look scale invariant because it looks like it depends on K if n is 1. And that's because the thing that you're normally looking at, there's several things. So there's two things. One is that what you're really interested in is in the position space thing. You're doing an integral over K, and there's some K's in the measure here, right? So if you write, what people do is they write, let me give this a name so we don't have to keep writing the angle brackets. So let's call this C rho of X. So what I'm doing here is I'm asking, why is N equals 1 scale invariant? And there's a sense in which it will be. So what I want you to think about is that C here is, if I write out what this, if I do the integrals over the angles here, and so let's suppose that that P doesn't depend on the direction of K, and it really is something that depends on the magnitude of K, then the dependence on K in the measure is this is K squared dK, and there's a bunch of angles going on. And so if we're going to track scale invariance, what we should do is we should write the measure in a scale invariant way, and it's the non-scale invariant part we should be looking at to see if it's scale invariant. So let's write this as dk over k times the angles. If I'd done the angle integrals, we would have had 4 pi over 2 pi cubed is 1 over 2 pi squared. So let me write that, I guess, over here. So we'll have del square of k. And if I'd done the integral, there's an angle hidden here, right? Because we've got a k dot x, and so that k dot x is that's kx cosine. I do that integral, I'm going to get a sine kx over kx. And then the 2 pi squared I'll put here. Or actually, I'll bury the 2 pi squared in the del squared. So with this definition of del squared, and I'll call this again del squared rho, so you remember we're talking about density, that would be k cubed p of k over 2 pi squared. So if we wanted to ask if things are scale invariant, this is now scale invariant, and this is kind of something which doesn't care so much about the value of k. And so this is kind of a more natural thing to ask scale invariant questions of. And so you can kind of see that if p rho were to go like a times k to the n, then del squared rho, because of the factor of k cubed, would go like a k to the n plus 3. So that doesn't look like a scale invariant either. But when people say it's scale invariant, what they mean is it's not that the correlation function of the density is scale invariant. What they mean is the correlation function for the Newtonian potential that the density would have given you is scale invariant, because that's actually the thing that measures the curvature of space-time, and that's what, in a relativistic treatment, you're tracking when you track the density fluctuations. So the Newtonian potential, remember, satisfies that del squared phi is 8 pi, what was it, 4 pi? 4 pi g rho. But from the point of, in momentum space, that says that phi k is proportional to delta k over k squared, because of that thing becomes a k squared. So if I did the same correlation functions for capital phi rather than rho, that would mean that if I did del squared for capital phi of k, that would be del squared of rho times k divided by k to the fourth, because I've got two deltas in the power spectrum. And so this is the thing that would have been in the scale, in a power law case, this would have gone like a k to the n plus 3 minus 4 is n minus 1. And so you can kind of see that if n were 1, this is the thing which would be the scale independent thing. And so the statement when you say it's scale invariant is you're saying that the curvature perturbations, which are the perturbations in the Newtonian potential, are the ones that are scale invariant. And the reason you care about those is that when we talk about the microwave background, so let me say that now. So you might have been surprised. What was the microwave background? That was the instant that atoms formed, where electrons found nuclei, and they produced neutral hydrogen, which then made the universe transparent. And so the temperature where that happens is going to be set by the temperature when atoms form, and they're no longer being dissociated. And I told you that that temperature has been measured. It's, you know, 2.7 something degrees. But I also told you that there were fluctuations in that temperature, and that might have puzzled you, because you might have said that the surface that the light last scattered from was almost defined by a temperature. You know, if it's really true that that surface of last scattering is the place where atoms formed, and atoms form when the universe reaches a temperature, that surface should always have the same temperature. So how can there be a fluctuation in the temperature is a thing you could have asked. So what I'm doing now is asking, why do you care about phi? I just did the same thing. I sent the same thing back that I sent down, didn't I? Try that again. So why care about phi rather than delta, or say the rho? The reason is this issue of last scattering. So the last scattering surface, you know, in general relativity, you've got a freedom in how you coordinate things. But a natural way to coordinate that last scattering surface would be as a surface where light last scattered, and so it's defined by a temperature. And then you would have to ask, why are there temperature fluctuations in the CMB, given that we're looking at a surface that's defined by a specific temperature? And in the language where you're labeling the last scattering surface by temperature, the way that you get temperature fluctuations is that in this story of structure formation, the light is decoupling from the baryons here, because that's when the atoms form. But in the meantime, the dark matter has been starting to cluster, because it started to cluster after radiation matter equality. So that means that while the light and the protons were all still scattering from one another, dark matter is starting to clump into regions which are denser here, say, and less dense there. So that when the baryons and the light no longer talk to each other anymore, what happens is that it's true that the surface of last scattering you can think of as being at a fixed temperature, but the light has to now get to you sometimes from within a potential well, because if the light is leaving you from an atom which is in one of the places where there's more dark matter, it's in a gravitational potential compared to the light that's not in one of those wells. And so when it climbs out, it's going to redshift, whereas the light coming from somewhere else won't redshift. And so in this language where you think of the center, surface of last scattering as being at a fixed temperature because that's where atoms form, the way that you see that there's temperature fluctuations is because there were gravitational potential wells that you had to climb out of, which are redshifting the light. That's called somebody's effect, SC probably effect. So now you have Zeldovitz effect. So light from the last scattering surface must climb out of the dark matter potential well to reach us, and is thereby redshifted. Therefore, redshifted by an amount controlled by phi. So what you're looking at when you're looking at the temperature fluctuations, you're looking at the phi fluctuations, because that's, in this language of way of thinking about it, that's the thing that controlled how much redshifting you had to do. So this is the SZ effect, I think. So that's kind of why people talk about that, and that's why its correlations are the most interesting for the point of view of scale invariance, and that's why n equals 1 is talked about as being the scale invariant spectrum, because that would be controlling a scale invariant spectrum for what you're actually seeing with this EMB. Okay. But to finish the thought, I still haven't told you why there's an observable feature to do with radiation matter equality. And so the idea will be that in the remote past, we're going to have reason to believe that there's a scale invariant spectrum happening. And if we look at the k-dependence of the distribution of either curvature perturbations or matter density perturbations, what we should be expecting from the story of radiation matter equality is that the ones for small k, when you look at the k-dependence of the modes for small k, you're seeing them as they in an unadulterated form, because they, as soon as they come inside the Hubble scale, They start to grow, and then you see them. You see a combination of what their initial density, what their initial amplitude was, plus how much they've grown since then as they grow during matter domination. Whereas the ones for large K don't quite do that. They have some initial distribution, but then they're frozen for some period of time until radiation matter transition happens, and then they grow. So what's happening is that the larger K modes are not, you're not seeing the pristine unadulterated evolution. You're seeing that after there was a pause, well, you waited for radiation matter domination to happen. And so if a mode came into the horizon inside the Hubble scale here, you had to wait till here before things started to grow. So that means that you should think of the power spectrum that you see now as being the primordial one processed through what they call as a transfer function, which is a thing that's telling you that the large K modes are being suppressed compared to what they could have been because they had to wait for radiation matter domination. So the power spectrum for any of these power spectra, if we calculate it now, so let's say T now, it will be the power spectrum, you know, as it was in the past, so T past, times some transfer function, which is possibly a function of K, which tells you how to get from to T now from T past. And this transfer function broadly, we know it's k-dependent because of this physics that it's going to tell us that the modes for which k is bigger than k equality, they're suppressed compared to what they would have been because they had to wait for radiation matter domination. So what I want to argue for you is that this thing is one if k is much less than k equality, but it goes like 1 over k to the fourth if k is much bigger than k equality, and that's expressing the stunting that's happening because the modes had to wait for radiation matter equality to happen. So when you look at the power spectrum, what you should see is that for small k, you see whatever the primordial thing is, and it's going to turn out to be this for n near 1. But for large k, it won't be that. It's going to do something because of this processing, because things had to wait for radiation matter equality in order to grow. So the last thing is I need to tell you why is how do you know that it's going like 1 over k to the fourth? So before I tell you that, though, so let me plot this. So if the primordial, so p of k t past goes like a k to the n, what will happen is that the one we actually see will go like, if I plot it against k, and if here's the k equality, it'll go like this power log, k, something starting off linear in k. But then if this is what's going on, if this is going like k, this will go like k to the minus 3. So it'll be much steeper. And people have measured the power spectrum. You can sample different k's, because that's like sampling different times, because the time when a mode crosses and starts to grow is a function of which k we're looking at. And the larger k's were the ones that crossed earlier, according to that plot. And the smaller k's are the ones that cross later. So by looking at galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so on at different redshifts, you can kind of map out what's going on here. And it really does this. So you see, this is what you see this growth for with k, linear in k, close to linear in k for small k. And then you see this drop off for large k. So why is it dropping off? So why is it k to the fourth? So the way to see that is that, you know, the basic physics is the modes that are here are suppressed by 1 over k to the fourth because they had to wait for they enter the Hubble scale at some time, and then they have to basically wait until radiation matter equality happens. So for k, bigger than k equality, we know that modes re-enter H before radiation matter equality. And so they are, because of that, they are amplified So delta, we know is going to go proportional to A, but we know how long it's gone proportional to A. It'll be just basically A divided by, it'll be, so if we take A is getting larger, so delta of T will go like A of T divided by whatever it was at radiation matter equality. And they all will, all these modes will share the same amplification factor because they're all starting at the same time and they're growing for that long. The difference for the smaller k's, for them, they come inside the Hubble scale when you're already in the matter-dominated area. So if you kind of look at them now, how long they've had to grow depends on k, because it depends on just when, all it depends on is when they crossed the Hubble scale. Modes grow as soon as start to grow. As soon as k is equal to ah. So let me say, let me denote by subscripts. If you give me a particular k, I'll denote by subscripts k the scale factor and the Hubble scale at the time that k satisfies this. I'll call a sub k and h sub k. So any mode with a fixed k is also going to grow proportional to a, but it's only going to do so since a sub k. Because that'll be the time, that's the time it's had to grow. And that'll be a k-dependent time because it just depended on exactly when the mode crossed the Hubble scale. But we know what the k-dependence of this is because, remember, I haven't erased it yet. Up there we said that during matter domination, which is what we want, we know that a times h goes like 1 over the square root of a. So this is something which is proportional to 1 over the square root of a. So that means that a sub k is proportional to k squared. So this is something which should be proportional to 1 over k squared. So that means that these modes are being have a k-dependent amplitude because of the time they've had to grow. The power spectrum is this squared, so it's going to go like 1 over k to the fourth. And that's where this came from. So this feature, k equality, you can easily read off by measuring the correlation of the density correlations or the curvature correlations in the sky. And it's there because it's telling you that growth, that structures formed because gravity was accreting onto things, and that couldn't start until radiation matter equality happened. And that's significant for dark matter because when it happens depends on how much matter you have. If you have less matter, it happens later. If we had only baryons, radiation matter equality would have happened at a later time where h is smaller and a is larger, and so all these numbers would have been different. And so the measurement of where this happens is telling you how much matter there is, and it's agreeing with all these other stories I'm telling you about how much matter there was, is the end of that kind of long song and dance. So both the shape is telling you the picture is right, that this picture of structure formation by accretion fits. It's got there's many k's you can measure, and the different k's are giving you a pattern which fits this whole story, and if it was some other thing that was giving you structure, it wouldn't have had to look like this. But then the values of places like where the transition happens and the total amplitude are telling you something about how much dark matter there is. Which again, whatever your theory of dark matter is, it has to get it right. Enough about that unless there's questions. I told you there's also a CMB story, but let me just kind of just say that in two words. So part of the cosmology evidence for dark matter comes from if you measure and this is where the directions count. So if you measure the temperature of the microwave background as a function of direction, so you take the temperature, and now I'll use a normal vector just describing direction. I take a temperature at a different direction, and you kind of ask, what's the correlation between the temperature in that direction to the correlation of that direction? But then you average it over every direction in the sky. So you're just asking for the relative distance. So this is a function of the relative theta between those two directions. So if n dot n prime is equal to cosine theta. And you can write that in terms of spherical harmonics, or in a way which I'll never remember if I don't read it. So actually what's really done is what we want is the change in temperature divided by the mean temperature. Change in temperature divided by the mean temperature. And that's the thing that is 1 over 4 pi, some L equals 0 to infinity of 2L plus 1 CL of PL of cosine theta, where these are the Legendre polynomials. And these C's you can measure because you can measure this. And that's those are the things that you, when you see these plots of C times some normalization, these things for the, you know, you see something like that, where that's happening at around L equals 180. That's for around L equals 1,000. And so the only thing I'm going to say here is that the size of these peaks and their position to some extent is affected by how much dark matter there is. And so when you, there's a lot of information here, right? Because you're measuring this for various L's, and there's a lot of L's that have been measured. So there's a, and it's, and the, and what you find is very well described by a small number of parameter fits that's telling you this basic picture of where it came from is probably right. But in addition, it's telling you the various parameters in your problem, including the amount of dark matter, control the shape of this curve. And the success of the agreement with the experiments is telling you what the parameters are. And more or less what's going on there is two things. That this peak, what you're seeing is, the physics of it is that so at radiation matter equality, the dark matter starts to grow, it starts to clump. Then you see the light coming from the CMB is climbing out of those potential wells. And one thing I didn't say last class, two things I didn't say last class. The last class, the whole calculation of the fluctuations, I started it from, I forgot the first line. I told you that V naught was H times R. But what I should have started off by saying was we're going to start off with R is equal to A times X. So that's very much like in cosmology. We have co-moving position, which is fixed. We have a physical position, which is a time-dependent function times X. If I differentiate that to get V, I get that. And that's why H was where H will be A dot over A. So this connection between the size of the universe and H, I made it sound like it was ambiguous or it was kind of subtle, but it's not. It's just I should have written this before I wrote that. That's one thing I forgot to do last time. But the thing I really wanted to tell you was, you know, when we derived a formula for delta, and the whole structure formation story I was telling you was coming from this formula here, that we had delta dot plus or minus, I think it was 8 pi g rho naught or something like that. I don't know if that 8 is right, delta. That's what the dominant density fluctuation was satisfying. And Peter, you asked, if we had radiation, how do you see that it's not going to grow? It just, if you just stick in H is the one for radiation domination, that's how you see that T. I gave you a solution which was T to the 2/3. And that relied on this being 2 over 3t. If you have 1 over 2t, then the solution is t is, it's log, delta's log t. But it's the same formula. If we'd done two fluids, you know, what we're looking at in the CMB is the baryons. This is the dark matter. But there's a similar, if we have two fluids and we did the same thing that I used to derive this, but for two fluids, just the same algebra, you'll get two equations like this. But what the only difference really is there's also, I guess I forgot to write, there's a plus c squared s k squared delta. And I forgot to tell you that this is the sign, when I say this is the speed of sound, the reason why is that the solution to this equation, this one and this one, if this is bigger, if this dominates this and this, then this is the wave equation, and that's the speed of sound of the waves, equals zero. But if we had another component of the fluid, we would have had the same kind of a story with, this would have been the dark matter piece. Dark matter, dark matter, dark matter. And there'd be a similar equation for the other component. You know, call it other component O plus 2H delta K O dot da da da. But the important thing is that in this piece, which was the density is essentially only the dark matter. So whereas I think of this as depending on, because the dark matter is dominant when we're interested in it, if we're in matter-dominated region. So whereas I think of this as being the same variable as was appearing in the other terms for the dark matter equation, from the point of view of the other components of the fluid, this piece is actually should be on the right-hand side, because it's something which is, so we'd have plus c squared s for the other thing, k squared delta k. But then this would be on the other side, we'd have 8 pi g rho naught delta dark matter. So the way to think about it is that the dark matter is doing something like I was telling you about. It's just it's growing, it's shrinking, it's doing whatever it does. But the other forms of matter are being driven by the dark matter because of the same term. This genes instabilities term for them is a driving force. And so the way to think about the CMB is it's like you have the baryons are all tied to the photons, and because the photons are relativistic, they don't clump. But as soon as you hit the last scattering surface and the photons now no longer talk to the baryons, they're free to start falling, and there's all these great holes to fall into that the dark matter's already formed. So the dark matter starts to drive the baryons, and so if you imagine, this is just some sort of a wave thing, if I imagine taking it's very much like an elastic. If I pulled an elastic and let it go, then that would be the dark matter hole that you're falling into, a wave goes out. And so if I have a initial thing like that as the source, then what happens is that a wave will come out if I just release it. This will start to oscillate, but at the same time, there'll be at later times, you might get something where this is oscillated down, but there'll be a wave that travels out. And this is kind of going to move out at the speed of whatever this thing is. And that's going to be, the 1 over root 3, because this starts off being photons. And so this starts at the matter radiation equality. The dark matter forms a hole. The baryons and the photons respond to it because they're being driven, and so but they're responding mostly the way radiation does because there's so many more photons and baryons. So this is something which is going out at 1 over root 3 times the speed of light. But then the light stops talking to the baryons and they stop basically. So the light keeps on going at the speed of light, but the baryons now have a non-relativistic speed, and so there's essentially it's like this whole wave just freezes. And so that correlation, and it freezes at a distance away from the initial perturbation. So what you find, the reason you're getting correlations between different directions in the CMB is because you start off with a dark matter density perturbation here, and the baryons respond to it, but they don't respond to it at the same place because they were moving, because they were a relativistic fluid, until they stopped, when they stopped coupling to the photons. And so the distance between the initial dark matter perturbation and where the baryons actually have an enhancement, and so that's something you see in the CMB, is set by the speed of sound and how far light could, or sound would have traveled in the time available to it. And so what you're measuring in that first correlation is essentially the sound horizon distance on the other side of the universe at the time of recombination. So it's something which is controlled by the speed of sound and hydrogen, this CS, which is not such a, mostly it's a radiation that's controlling that. But it's also being it's controlled by the intervening, the angle that you measure. This is an angle. Remember, this is all being done in terms of angles. The distance is being fixed by sound, but then you have to see that through the geometry of the universe in between. So there's some sort of a triangle like we talked about last class. So we know this is the sound horizon. This is the size of the universe, which depends on the Hubble scale, say, and this is some angle. And so this depends on the total amount of stuff in the universe, because it's the thing that the Friedmann equation relates to everything. And so you're partly sensitive in the position of this thing to the dark matter because it's controlling the geometry through which you're looking to convert this physical distance to an angle. But it's also true that the reason these things are going down is that there's a damping process going on, that the light doesn't stop, the atoms don't form instantaneously. There's a small range of redshifts over which they form, and the photons are diffusing around a little bit in that time. So they tend to smear things out, and that's called silt damping. And that's all to do with the photons diffusing through the baryons, so that cares about how many baryons you have. And so the ratio of the size of these peaks is also sensitive to the total amount of dark matter compared to the total amount of baryons. And so the detailed shape here is also depending on the dark matter. And the great triumph of dark matter models, or dark matter fits, is that the dark matter you need for galaxies, the dark matter you need for clusters of galaxies, measured in many different ways, the dark matter you need for structure formation, the dark matter you need for this, and the amount of baryons you need for nucleosynthesis, they're all giving you the same answer. And so the fact that there's many, many ways of getting that answer is the important thing. And if you compare now a theory of dark matter, it has to get it all right. Yeah.
So sometimes you hear that the correlations of the CMB are due to some primordial fluctuations.
Yeah.
So is that a different correlation of this one?
No, it's the same one. So it's all this p function. So this p thing.
So is that from the inflationary era or when you say primordial fluctuation?
Yeah. So the question you're asking is I'm telling you a story about, you know, sound horizons and all that kind of stuff. And so for the shape of everything from about here on, it's all about the sound horizon of the physics at the recombination. But for the very, very large angles, which has got a small L, that's the very, very big parts of the sky where there hasn't been time for things to get there from there to there. So you're essentially seeing the pristine primordial fluctuations in this part of it. So but you can derive these Cs, if you know what these Ps are, if you know what this is, you can figure out what those Cs are because you're doing your first question was. If you knew the distribution of matter and of a matter everywhere in the universe, what you can do is you can then project it. You can figure out the relationship between the temperature and the density, and they're basically similar for the baryons because it's like an ideal gas, so the temperature and the pressure are tracking each other. So if you can track what the density of the baryons is, you can tell what the temperature is as a function of three-dimensional position, and then you can kind of project that onto the sky, and you can, by convoluting it with some spherical Bessel function, you can turn the power spectrum there into the CCLs. So the information that's here is also here. And so the part of P that goes like this, so for small k, that's the things that are, small k is large distances, that's what's controlling the small angle part, or the large angle part, the small L part. And so that's the primordial part. And then the stuff that's here, and for large K, is about the details of the physics that's happened at the last scattering. So it's all the information's in there. It's a really, whenever someone hands you a function worth of information, they've given you a lot of information, and so that's kind of what's happening. Yeah. Thanks for asking that. All right, so let's take an example of I'm going to do two examples of things to explain dark matter. And the most important thing is the wealth of things you're trying to explain. And I think that there's a variety of models. And in the dark matter section, the main message I want to get across is that there are a variety of healthy models. And there's no shortage of healthy models. But not all models are equally healthy. And so the natural distinction here, the two I'm going to highlight are modifying gravity, which I'll just spend a very little bit of time on, because the short version is there's no one modification of gravity which gets all this right. And it's not clear that there won't be one, but right now, if you ask what's the preponderance of evidence, there's no evidence that there's a modified gravity that gets all this right. And I want to contrast that with, you have a WIMP, I'll take a specific example of an extra kind of a particle, and the message there will be that it's actually, dark matter models are like dirt, that every graduate student every Monday makes a new dark matter model. And it's because it's easy. It says there's only three things you have to have true, and two of them are true for free. So there's only one thing you have to arrange. And then once you arrange it, you get almost all of the stuff right. And the almost part is the important part. There's some features of galaxy formation that it's not clear that you get them right, but it's also not clear that they've been calculated carefully enough to tell yet. But that's the thing you watch, is that you watch for any one model, what part of the model, what part of the evidence is it having the hardest time with? And what the summary will be is that for modified gravity models, they do the best with galaxies, that's kind of their sweet spot, but then they have a hard time with cosmology and structure formation and clusters of galaxies, whereas the dark matter models do well at a first approximation for everything, but the details of the galaxy formation, they're not getting, they may be getting it right, but it's not clear that they're getting it right yet, I think. Not clear they're getting it wrong yet, but that's the thing you want to watch. So let me just very quickly say, my watch is slow, it turns out, okay? So just like for 2 minutes, I want to just start the modified gravity part, unless there's questions. So if there's questions on, about to stop talking about evidence. All right. And my point here is not to pee on people's models. It's just that, you know, when you're in theoretical physics, your job is to partly be creative and think about new ideas and how things could work. But then the other part of the job is you have to sit back then and assess how well did you do. compared to the evidence. And unless you do both, you're not doing your job. So this is like modified gravity example. And I'm going to use as this example MOND, which is a MOND I alluded to last time. And the idea is a really simple idea. And it's so the, remember for galaxies, you had these rotation curves, you know, V against R. They did something and they started to go flat. So there's a constant at infinity that they went to, or for large R. And you expected that should have gone like GM of R over R. But then, since this is a constant, that would mean that the density is only going like 1 over r squared. And if you actually drew the galaxy here, the visible galaxy might look like that. So you're looking at gas clouds that are well outside of where the stars all were. And so you're committing yourself to saying there's a lot of stuff outside where the stars were. But the MOND observation is that, supposing it were true, before I say that, the transition here where dark matter starts to dominate, there's very little evidence for during dark matter in the middle of the galaxy, the center of the galaxy. It seems to be most important outside. And the transition point depends on the galaxy you're looking at. So if you remember, if you look at R dark matter divided by the scale height of the galaxy, of the disk, that's something which depends on the luminosity. And another thing you're trying to get right is we know that observationally V infinity to the fourth, there's a power which is around 4, seems to go like the luminosity. So whatever is happening with dark matter, the importance of dark matter knows in some way about the luminous matter. And there's a connection there that whatever your theory is should explain. And that's the thing that this thing nails. It does a great job of explaining it. So the idea is, you know, you thought this was true because at the level of acceleration, that was the thing that was GM over R squared. So what the proposal of MOND is to say that, supposing it were true that the left-hand side here was really a function of acceleration over some scale, where F of A over A naught is A for A much bigger than A naught, but instead it's something like the square root of A naught A if A is much less than A naught. Supposing you could arrange that to be true with your dynamics, then you can kind of see what's happening, right? That in this regime, what you'd expect to have is that things will look very much like ordinary Newtonian mechanics. And on this kind of a picture, that'll be small radii, because the smaller r is, the bigger the accelerations are. But eventually, you'll hit a point where the acceleration will be a naught. And a naught, they'll fit from looking at these rotation curves, and it's something like 10 to the minus 10 centimeters per second squared, because astronomers use CGS units. I have no idea why. But you can kind of see that what this does for you is that if this is true, then what you're saying here is that instead of, if the square root of A is proportional to GM over R squared, then that says that A will be going like GM over R squared squared. And so that means that V squared over R will go like that. So if I multiply through by R, if I've done this right, V squared should go like GM squared over R cubed, and I did it wrong. Shit, what did I do wrong? I took the square root of the wrong side. Damn. You can kind of see where they're going. It's I should have written this as try again, a squared over a naught. So now a squared over a naught will go like that. So then that says that v squared over r should go like the square root of this side, right? Square root of gm over r squared. And that'll say that v squared should go like, so the square root of this, I'll get r here, the r's will cancel, and the v squared is going to go like the square root of GM. And that says that, so now you don't have any dark matter, you go outside where all the visible stuff is. So now M is just a constant because it's you no longer have any density. So this is a constant, and that's why these curves are constant. But then you do a great job of this, because what should happen is that you should be finding that v to the fourth is proportional to m squared, or sorry, m. And then the statement is that's proportional to the luminosity. And that's good, because when you, I told you when we, if we had tried to explain these curves by saying that there was a new force, remember, if we had gm over r squared plus m times u of r, the problem was when we asked what was the value of v that you get when you design u to do whatever it's supposed to do, is we got an answer which said that the mass and the luminosity were not proportional to each other. And that's a bad description of galaxies. If you look at the mass and you look at the luminosity and you count it all up and look at the ratio, they're normally proportional to one another. So this is a huge success. So the fact that that's proportional to that, that just says that you might have a little bit more stars or maybe a little bit less stars. So the order one number, if you look at m over l, that'll be some number times the solar mass divided by the solar luminosity. And that number might depend a little bit on how many stars you have or how much gas. But the scaling is typically a good scaling for galaxies. And so one of the huge successes of this is that it kind of can immediately nail why v squared over r, v squared is doing what it's doing. And it's also telling you the transition should naturally be happening in a place which is proportional to the luminosity. So what they do is they take all these galaxy curves and they fit them to these parameters that they fit it to is a naught, and they allow m over l for each galaxy to be fit, because this numerical factor here could be different for different galaxies, and it does a great job. And so it's so that statement that this a naught, wherever it was, the fact that galaxies seem to know about that acceleration in this transition from dark matter dominated to not dark matter dominated is an important fact. And if particle dark matter is true, it should be able to explain it too. And it's not clear that it does. So that's the success of these models. And then from here on in, it's downhill a little bit. So the next class, I'll pick that up. And remember, next class, we'll start early because there's some sort of festivities happening tomorrow. So we start at quarter two. That'll get us out in time.
So is there like a correction to Einstein-Hilbert action that just give us this?
That'll be the next class. So one of my messages in this course is, if you have a theory, if you can phrase the theory in terms of an effective action, you're way ahead of the game for many reasons. One of which is that you can ask, if you have an action that gives you this, you can ask, does it make sense? Is it unitary? Is it stable? But also you can ask about conservation laws. You can ask, what does this do in other areas where you test gravity? And so there's a non-relativistic version of this, and there's a relativistic extension of that. And I think the best state of the art now is that relativistic extension, the Tevez theory. I'll write it down and not say much about it. And it's not clear that it's stable in all cases, but that's the language in which you'd want to really test this in a real way.